I've always said two things. When I leave a job, I want to leave it better than I found it, and I want to leave the cupboard full. Had I left at the end of June of last year, I don't think those two things would have been true. I certainly feel like we've done a good job and it's better than I found it, but I didn't feel like we were leaving the cupboard full. With this year and recruiting with Matt Brown and John Gallant, I really feel like the group we've got coming in with the fifth year guys that are coming back, I feel like we're leaving the cupboard full. I wanted to make sure that with Matt especially, that he was ready, willing, and able, which, and I knew the I knew the answer to all three of those was yes, but I wanted to confirm for myself that I was doing everything I could for him to prepare him to be the next head coach.
Welcome back to the D-Fly and Dixie podcast, featuring Big Ten Network, ESPN, and Inside Lacrosse analyst and my Hopkins homeboy, Mark Dixon. I am your host, Dan Flynn. Today's episode is presented by Simplicity Group. Simplicity Group is a leading financial products distribution firm that specializes in providing best-in-class insurance, investment, and business development solutions. This is a special episode. As you heard, we were able to sit down with Denver coach Bill Tierney on the eve of what could be his last game as a head coach. It's a fascinating, candid interview, and not to mention, but there are so many critical games, and since conference tournament semifinals begin on Thursday, we're putting this out a day early. So, Dixie, let's get it. Dixie, it's May. It's tournament time. Postseason has begun. It's what everybody plays for. And this episode is supersized with our conversation with Coach T.
Yeah, it's that time of year to expand. Everybody wants tournament expansion. Not going to happen. Can't happen. Already the ratio is out of whack with the number of Division I lacrosse teams playing in the men's side and the number of teams that qualify for the NCAA tournament. But yeah, I need to, I need some, I'm not a coffee drinker. I see you drinking a cup of Joe. I might need some. We're recording this on Wednesday because it is dropping Thursday. It was a long day yesterday for the Dixons. We had a Loyola High School game. Dons went down to Severna Park to take on Severn. And then from there, my wife and I jumped over to Marine Corps Stadium to watch the Loyola Greyhounds defeat Navy in the first round of the Patriot League quarterfinals. But that's where we are right now. You know, you're running hot and heavy. Kids that play the sport are managing postseason tournaments, papers, presentations, exams. So you and I, we have to be on point. We've got to up our game.
Absolutely. We always do this time of year. We always do.
That's right. That's right. Oh, hold on. Before we get going, when I listened to the podcast back last week, when I went to the gym, I didn't call you to the carpet that Bennett plays baseball.
Yeah.
I didn't call you to the carpet. I let that one slide.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
So as many listeners know, my wife was a, you know, she was played at Penn for 4 years. She's a captain on the team, big lacrosse person. I work at Inside Lacrosse. I went
she
to
played
Hopkins.
Lacrosse at Penn. She didn't play softball.
She played lacrosse at Penn. But I, you know, I never played because when I grew up in Delaware, it just really wasn't an opportunity at the time. And I played baseball. And now my son played lacrosse last year when he was six, and my daughter plays. She's nine. She's already playing on a travel team. That was fun.
Oh, Sandy she's already sucked into the club scene. Wife running around with the martini bar or whatever the heck she runs around with at the games.
Standing at Garrison Forest last Sunday in a downpour. The best part wasn't just the game. It was that hour in between the games where everyone was wet and we had to wait for that second game at 4 o'clock.
Oh, isn't that fun?
Yeah, it's just so much fun.
Did you at least have a tent? Canopy?
We did. We have all of that stuff, but
yeah.
She wanted to go get something to eat. So we ran out to, so she's in the Burger King bathroom drying off her jersey with the air dryer. It's like, what's taking so long? Because I'm outside holding her towel as she runs in the bathroom.
Oh.
So, you know, one of those. So that's what it looked like. At least in baseball, Bennett's game was canceled on Monday because it was
ready. Ah, there so, you
know,
go. Yeah, you can't, even if they have turf for baseball, you're canceling.
Yeah, so he you know, the Orioles, I think we talked about this, the surge of the Orioles last year,
That's
all
right.
those young
You guys really
players,
got into the O's.
and he
Yeah.
got really into it, and we watch a lot of baseball now, and it's, you know, it's fun. That's what he wants to do. He
Okay.
said that he wants to play lacrosse again though, and I tried to
Good.
explain to him that that might be tough long term to play both of them, but if it's for fun, we'll get him on a team, and maybe who knows. He wasn't bad at lacrosse either, so, but
Yeah.
he's good at baseball. He's really good actually.
That's good. Of course, it was 100 years ago, but I did baseball and lacrosse up until I was about 11. And I can still remember going from lacrosse practice to a baseball game or vice versa. And I think halfway through the season, my father, as I was changing in the back seat for the 50th time, he's like, "Okay, decision time. You got to pick one or the other." And
Now and
I picked lacrosse. But my baseball team, we were the Red Sox. We won the championship, the league championship that year, and I made a diving catch in the semifinal game to get us to the championship. And then in the championship, we rocked somebody. So at least I went out a winner on the diamond.
yeah, you really remember all of that too. Thanks for sharing.
I do.
Nowadays, you would have had to make a decision when you were seven of
Yeah,
which sport
right.
you wanted to
To
play.
commit full time and go
Yeah,
train and,
get on a club team.
strength and conditioning coach and nutrition plan and all that stuff. Isn't it great?
It's great. I love it though. You know, whatever's best for the
Yeah.
kids.
As long as
And
you're happy.
I sometimes ask, is it really best for the kids? All right, Dixie, just a refresher course for people. If your conference has six teams, at least six teams, you can earn an automatic qualifier. Championship team of your tournament gets an automatic bid to the NCAA tournament. Most leagues have those. The ACC is the one conference that stands out as only five members, all really good lacrosse programs, but they are not having a conference tournament.
Yeah, the ACC will get at least three teams in. North Carolina could be the fourth, depending upon how they do this weekend against Notre Dame and how some other tournaments go. But that is the reason this year, in absence of the tournament, that's why Duke played Syracuse twice. North Carolina will play Notre Dame twice, Virginia, Notre Dame. That's why those teams are playing, some of them are playing each other twice.
So we'll go through the weekend previews, and we're down to the conference semifinals. So some of the larger leagues played their quarterfinals last weekend or earlier this week. Now it's down to each league's four best squads. So as we normally do, we'll go through chronologically through the schedule, conference by conference, starting with the earliest game time. And that starts on Thursday, the Big Ten semifinals at Johns Hopkins University, Homewood Field. And Michigan, the four seed, will play number one Penn State, who's 9-3, tied for the league championship with Hopkins, but gets the top seed via their head-to-head win. That game's at 1 o'clock, and you'll be on the call on BTN with that game.
Yes, so I know I shared this last week, but for to reiterate, the reason that these games are so early, 1 and 3:30, is because the women's tournament in the Big Ten has been moved to the same day as the men's. So in the past, men have been Thursday, Saturday, semifinal championship. Women have been Friday, Sunday. But with that championship being on Sunday, typically both teams that play in that final in the Big Ten women's side go to the NCAA tournament. The NCAA tournament begins on a Friday, and the women's coaches felt as if, they've basically lost 2 days of preparation. So that's why the tournament has been moved to same day. And this year, the men get the matinee, women get prime time. I've been told that'll probably flip next year. So that's the reason. But what a year for that to happen, because instead of a 7 o'clock face-off between Hopkins and Maryland at Homewood Field, that could draw upwards of 5,000, 6,000 people. Well, on the conservative side, it's being played at 3:30, and that will be a challenge for the crowd. So, and this the rivalry has juice again after Hopkins knocked off Maryland a couple weeks ago, 13-12. I think it was 13-12, beat them by a goal. So, in any event, Penn State, the number one seed, what a great turnaround! What 3-11 a year ago, now 10-3 this year. Jeff Tamburini, rightly so. The Big Ten Coach of the Year, TJ Malone, Offensive Player of the Year, Jack Fracion, Specialist of the Year, when last year they had nothing, so great turnaround for Penn State. They play a Michigan team that is coming off of a second consecutive win over Ohio State. A lot of momentum coming into Baltimore. They've got three terrific scorers in Mikey Boehm, Josh Jawada, and Ryan Cohen. They've got a two-headed monster at the faceoff dot, Wheatfeldt and Rowlett, and they're playing with a ton of confidence. And there are a number of people that feel like if Michigan can beat Penn State, they have an, you know, they could win the Big Ten championship. So Michigan right now is a bid stealer. If they were to win, you know, they need to win the Big Ten tournament to go to the NCAA tournament, you know, and then you got Hopkins and Maryland on the other side, a rematch of a game a couple weeks ago. This is what Big Ten play provides to each of these teams. Right now, this is a three-bid conference. Penn State, Johns Hopkins, Maryland will go to the NCAA tournament. The question is, you know, will they remain seeds? You know, I think Penn State hosts if they go to the Big Ten final. I think Hopkins hosts regardless. And I think that Maryland needs to win against Hopkins in order to be a seed. If Michigan wins, they're a bid stealer. It will be a four-bid league.
Great breakdown of that, Dixie. Let's move on to the Metro Atlantic Athletic Conference semifinals. These are at Manhattan in Riverdale, New York on Thursday. The games are at 3-7. Manhattan earned the number one seed in the MAC. They will play Siena in the second game at 7, but it opens up with number two Mount St. Mary's playing Marist, the 2-3 game at 3 p.m. on Thursday.
Interesting. Normally the number one seed gets the earlier game. They get that extra rest, but hats off to Manhattan, the Jaspers, not only the number one seed in the MAC, some action, but they knocked off Navy earlier this year, which is, that's a benchmark victory for that program. And then, you know, Mount St. Mary's, Tommy Gravante doing a great job there. You know, Siena's been to the NCAA tournament a number of times under leadership of, you know, former Siena bench boss, now the head coach at Rutgers, Brian Brecht. I remember Brian being in the Siena chair for a number of years. And then Marist, our good friend Keegan Wilkinson, a Columbia, Maryland native and a loyal listener to the podcast. Obviously, this is a one-bid league, and typically the champion of the MAC goes to the play-in game. But still a gigantic deal for all these four teams to have an opportunity to win a conference championship and to advance to the NCAA tournament. I think it's unfair. Like, some people don't consider the play-in game that you've made it to the NCAA tournament. I think that's bogus. You absolutely have made it to the big dance, even if you're in that play-in game.
In the CAA, hosted by top seed Delaware in Newark, Delaware, the first game features the number one top-ranked Blue Hens, top seed, playing number four Towson in a rematch of last week. That game's at 5:30 in the nightcap. Number two Drexel will play Stony Brook at 8:30.
You know, hats off to the Towson Tigers pulling the upset against the Blue Hens a week ago. That could have been the best thing that happened to Delaware. You know, maybe getting that end of regular season loss, they still maintain the number one seed, and you get the team that beat you a week ago again. You know, so I think Delaware is a team that has impressed me. I've seen them live. That loss could prove to be a real positive for Ben DeLuca's Blue Hens. And then you look at the 2-3 matchup, you know, Drexel, led by Brian Volker, taking on Stony Brook, who came over from the America East to join the Colonial Athletic Association. So congratulations to the Seawolves making it to the, you know, their first ever CAA tournament. One bid league, even if Towson, Drexel, or Stony Brook is able to win, Delaware, I don't think, gets in as an at-large if they can't win the automatic qualifier. You know, when you look at their metrics, 32nd in the RPI. So this is a one bid league, and whoever wins this tournament this weekend is going to go.
In Richmond, Virginia, predetermined host site of the Atlantic 10 semifinals, where St. Joe's will be the number one seed. St. Joe's will play High Point at 5:30 on Thursday, followed by Richmond and UMass, the 2 and 3 seeds, at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, the amalgamation, it's like a combination of the Northeast Conference, the CAA, and the old SoCon. You know, St. Joe's, I think, goes in. They go in as the favorite. Again, another one-bid league. I've seen the Hawks play live. They've got some nice offensive punch. Goaltending's been an issue. Tough defense. And Zach Cole, the faceoff man, one of the best in the business. They'll take on a High Point team that is fun to watch. They can score goals. And then you've got Richmond and UMass, you know, SoCon, the old SoCon versus the old CAA. And you know, give a little bit of a nudge, I guess, to Richmond, the Spiders. They get to host and they get the home cooking. So it should be a fun weekend. I think the weather's supposed to improve. It's been kind of crummy in the mid-Atlantic area this week with some wet and chilly. I think it's supposed to warm up a little bit. So depth will play a role. But, you know, should be a really fun tournament in the Atlantic Sun.
The Big East caps the action on Thursday, and we'll get to that after this break. Today's episode is presented by Simplicity Group. Simplicity is a leading financial products distribution firm that specializes in providing best-in-class insurance, investment, and business development solutions. By way of organic growth and acquisition of top financial distribution and technology companies, Simplicity has become one of the largest organizations of its kind. Simplicity seeks to attract the industry's best in leadership, talent, advisors, and future partners so that it may continue to influence the way businesses succeed in the independent financial services sector. To learn more, visit simplicitygroup.com. All right, Dix, Big East semifinals. They're at Marquette, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I've always said that there's nothing worse than being the host team and not playing. Number one, Georgetown, top seed and well-earned. Play Providence in the first game at 6:30. These are East Coast times, not local. And then Denver plays Villanova in the nightcap at 9:30. And before we talk about this, let's bring in our guest this week, Denver head coach Bill Tierney. Please welcome into the show the head coach of the Denver Pioneers, Bill Tierney. Ranked ninth in this week's Inside Lacrosse Media poll, the Pioneers closed the regular season with a record of 9-4 and will play Villanova on Thursday night in the Big East semifinals. Coach, thank you for joining us on the D-Fly and Dixie podcast.
No, thanks for having me, guys. It's an honor. You guys do a great job, and you know, I'm just thrilled to be still kicking to have these kinds of things. So it's all good.
Now, Coach, we've been looking forward to talking with you all season long. Before we started recording, we shared that with you. I know you've given several interviews since you made the announcement a few months ago that this would be your final season as a head coach. But for our listening audience, because, you know, our listeners don't listen to any other lacrosse stuff, right? at least we like to think that. If you could just run us through the thought process, why now? Why the announcement before the season, and you know, just really how you've gotten to this point.
Yeah, it's been through it, Mark, and a lot of things transpired over the years. And I think the best way I've been able to kind of put it into a Reader's Digest version is I've been blessed. I've been blessed throughout my career, my family, my players, my assistant coaches, everybody. So one of the things I've been blessed with over the years is I've had the opportunity to have my teams play in front of 40, 50,000 people. And I don't know if it had anything to do with COVID or not, but we still play some games at some sites where there might be 40 people at the game. And interestingly enough, in the last couple of years, I've just felt more anxious in front of that 40 than I have in front of that, than I did in front of that 40 or 50,000. And so, you know, I just felt like something was going on, and I had to do, you know, obviously speak with my wife, Helen, and do a deep search on not just the X's and O's part of it, which I'll get to in a minute, but more of where am I at in my life? I've been blessed. I'm knock on wood, I'm in good health. Some people asked me yesterday, you know, is there anything to do with health or anything? And absolutely not. Other than being blind and deaf, I'm in pretty good shape. But, you know, so it got to that. And then it got to, there's a lot going on in higher education, certainly more so that that doesn't allow me the flexibility to change. And what I mean by that is, you know, all the stuff that's going on with, whether it's politics in education or social media, or you know, all these different things that go on that make coaching not coaching as much coaching as has was in the past. You know, when I was at Great Neck South and Levittown Memorial and RIT, I was washing clothes and I was lining fields and I was coaching the heck out of our kids. And coaching, recruiting, and that stuff was what a coaching job was. And so as the years have gone on, and, you know, certainly still so thankful for Don Zimmerman and Bob Scott to hire me at Hopkins, and then, you know, Bob Meislick at Princeton, and then certainly Peg Bradley Dauppas here. As the years went on, you know, coaching, just like every profession, has changed over the years. And so with coaching, you have young assistant coaches, and they can really help you if they're honest, like Matt Brown and my son Trevor and David Metzbauer have been over the years, like, coach, you know, you can't say that anymore. Or a coach, you know, that was old school 20 years ago. So, you know, let's move on. And so allowing yourself to be surrounded by people that are smart, that love you, that are willing to be honest with you and support you every day. In coaching, that's a great thing. But in all this other stuff, you kind of feel like every time I do something, I say, well, can you say that anymore? Can you do that anymore? Is that how kids react to that anymore? And I think it's wise sometimes to, as I said, since January 6th, you know when you know. And it's not any one defined thing. It's just something coming up. And I think I had, you know, we started really thinking about this last year, but I've always said two things. When I leave a job, I want to leave it better than I found it, and I want to leave the cupboard full. Had I left at the end of June of last year, I don't think those two things would have been true. I certainly feel like we've done a good job and it's better than I found it, but I didn't feel like we were leaving the cupboard full. With this year and recruiting with Matt Brown and John Gallant, I really feel like the group we've got coming in with the fifth year guys that are coming back. I mean, basically our whole team will be back next year. I feel like we're leaving the cupboard full. I wanted to make sure that with Matt, especially, that he was ready, willing, and able, and I knew the answer to all three of those was yes, but I wanted to confirm for myself that I was doing everything I could for him to prepare him to be the next head coach. And then certainly talking to my children and my family and understanding that, you know, I need to do more things in my life. I got four grandchildren. I've got four amazing kids and they've all, and an amazing wife that they've all spent their lives supporting me in my journey. And it's about time that they get some of that time back. So coming into, you know, the decision and when to announce the decision, talking to my boss here and everything, talking to Brownie, we just came to a point where we said, it wouldn't be fair to this team to not know, because there's such a great group of guys. I mean, this group of young men is just amazing. And when I did announce it, I told them that it's sad that they're the last group, but I wouldn't want to go out with any other group knowing how they've, you know, done anything they could for me and for our program. So it all just came to fruition. And I felt like, we set the date for January 6th. I wasn't thrilled with the thought of going through it. And some of my peers have been done amazing, amazing things for me on the road. Certainly Joe Bresci at Carolina, and John Donowski at Duke, and now Andrew Stimmel this past week, and Sean Nadlin when we played Towson. I didn't really want that stuff, but the fact that they all did it tells me that, you know, you're in this profession, you got to win, you got to lose and all that stuff, but you make relationships that go farther and deeper than whether you win or lose a recruit that's 17 years old. And so kind of with all that in mind, and with the support of my family, the support of my coaches here, the support of our administrators, we did it what I feel is the right way. And had to go through things like Bill Tierney Day and the angst that provided, last home game last week, that provided. But at the end of the day, I couldn't be more thankful for the way it's transpired and for being given to me the opportunity by all these people to go out the way I wanted to.
And you just mentioned, you know, the Bill Tierney day and the last, you know, there's a lot of last for you this season. How would you best describe, you know, you just hit on it a little bit, but I would, if you could further elaborate, you know, the respect that you've been shown by opponents and coaches that you've competed against for a long time, but as you mentioned, you're friends with. What has that experience been like this year? Because obviously it's unique, nothing you've ever faced before in your career.
Yeah, it's interesting, Mark, because I think one thing I've done really well, and there was Patrick Stevens did an interview with Jack Tortolani, who, when we were in Baltimore, and Jack's dad Justin was my first recruit at Princeton, and I was happy with Jack's quote that basically said I talked to my dad and we compared notes about how he coaches. And it doesn't seem like anything has changed. And so I felt good about that, because one of the last things I wanted to do was count down or say, it doesn't matter, it's my last year anyway. You know, I've been blessed with these championships and all these great guys. I didn't want to do that because, you know, there's a great Bill Parcells quote from years ago in Sports Illustrated that basically said, you know, there's a thin curtain between being a winner and a loser, and it all depends on your last game. And that's how I've approached this year. The only thing that matters right now is Thursday night. And so I think I've been able to do that pretty well. And if you ask my players with the tirade I went on yesterday, I think they would say the same.
Coach, you touched on it a little bit, how much college sports and the way lacrosse is seen over the years. You're thinking of your early days as a Johns Hopkins assistant, when you also had to serve as the head coach of men's soccer to earn, you know, full-time status. And now every college lacrosse staff in Division I has two full-time assistants, you know, a director of operations, a volunteer coach who more or less only coaches lacrosse. But in direct and indirect ways, you and a handful of your colleagues have helped drive this evolution. Can you reflect on that and the growth of the sport and the way that lacrosse is seen as a real valuable asset to a college and a university?
Yeah, I mean, what you asked, Dan, is so encompassing. It's first of all, when you talk about that coaching situation, you know, what saved me at Hopkins, even though I had to be the soccer coach, was that I had made my living up to that point of staying anywhere I showed up for only 3 years, trying to, I kind of had what I thought was a blueprint for taking programs from one level and getting them to the next, or helping get them to the next. And certainly the soccer job was thrown at me, and I'm so thankful for that experience. It taught me so many lessons. The young men that I coached in soccer at Hopkins, you know, as everybody knows, Hopkins is a Division III institution with Division I lacrosse. And so you're talking about night and day when you go from this office coaching soccer to that office coaching lacrosse. And but the soccer guys at Hopkins were so memorable for me, because maybe the first time in my life, you know, I had to admit that this micromanager of everybody didn't know a thing about what he was doing. And so what I learned was the ability to go to the kids and say, look, I can do certain things. I promise you I'll recruit and I'll get more better guys. And I promise you, if you screw up, I'll yell and scream at you, right? But you got to understand that I will take your leadership. Now, these are guys that are engineers, pre-med guys, Division III athletes that were just basically at Hopkins to get that great education and play some Division III soccer. And so by doing that, and then going from 7-9 to 14-3 to 14-3-1 and making the NCAA tournament, it showed me that there was a lot more to this thing than just pounding, you know, your thoughts. I do a talk once in a while called, you know, the square peg in a round hole, you know, where you try to pound it into people's heads. I couldn't pound anything into these guys' heads because I didn't have anything to pound. And so that really helped me. And then going forward, and the other thing that really helped me at Hopkins is the trust that Zim and Freddie Smith gave me. The comfort that I had back then, I didn't realize it was comfort at the time, but was the fact that there was no coaching limitations there. So it was probably, I was probably one of 11 coaches. I could probably go back and name them, but I was the only one who didn't graduate or play at Hopkins. So it allowed me another opportunity to be flexible in what I did. And I always talk about the story where we used to meet on Sunday nights in my first year, 1985. And, you know, I was basically my name was the first assistant coach. My reality was the ball boy. And so I was Freddie Smith's underling. And I've said it now and I've said it forever. I learned more from Freddie Smith in those 3 years than anybody, any other individual. But Freddie, the thing I learned most from him was how much he trusted me. And so we were going into play Syracuse in the championship game. There was no Final Four in 85. It started in 86. I made a recommendation. I'm not going to dive into it, but I made a defensive recommendation. And some of my other good friends on the staff kind of told me, hey, go collect the balls, you know. And what Freddie didn't, Freddie stood up and he said, it's about time we listen to this guy. And I still feel like that moment was my watershed. That, you know, and because they did. And it was something very simple, but it helped us beat Syracuse the next week. And so, you know, I'll always be indebted to Freddie for that. But so certainly the Hopkins experience wasn't just leading me out on a rope, but it was comforting, but it was challenging. But it was also a great learning experience to get me. And the people at Princeton would tell you, well, if you were an assistant at Hopkins, where we won 2 out of 3 years national championships, you must know something about lacrosse. But it was the other thing that Princeton had fallen on some hard times there, had a great history of lacrosse, that I gained the confidence and they gained confidence in me from the soccer job, which is kind of strange.
You used the word several times there, Coach, comfort. And I can picture it almost. Would you use those words as well to say that you had a comfort level in staying at Princeton when other schools came, in particular Johns Hopkins with their head coaching vacancy? And then fast forward a number of years, a comfort in leaving Princeton and going to a place like the University of Denver?
Yeah, and it's a great question, Mark. And I think it shows you that words sometimes can have very varied meanings. You know, my comfort in staying at Princeton, and I've told this story often, came from 4 inches away from me as Helen and I were driving back from our interview at Hopkins back up to Princeton. And, you know, Helen's not a crier, and she's a tough Queenswoman. And when I saw that tear running down her eye, I said to her, I guess we're not going, huh? She goes, no, you made a promise to these guys, to Batch and somebody, Kevin Lowe and Scott Reinhart and these guys, Justin Tortolani, and I could go through the whole plethora of names, that they were going to win a championship and they were going to do it under you. And so I still get emotional about it, because that comfort came from outside of me. That came from my belief in my wife and belief that, like most times, she knows better than I, whether it got to do with family or children or my life in general. So, you know, that comfort came from without. Fast forward to that comfort after 22 years at Princeton, where I was honestly afraid of the comfortability of going on an automatic pilot. You know, I could have rode it out for another 14 or 15 years and, you know, nobody would have ever taken away those 6 championships. Maybe we would have got another one, maybe not. But that comfort came from within, and it was helped again by a family member, by Trevor, who was out here, my son Trevor. And the comfort was that I knew I could make a change. I knew I could get back to the old me, which was to help a program, you know, get from somewhere to somewhere else. But I was very comforted and confident that we could do that here, especially in light of when I met Matt Brown and Trevor promised me he'd be on the staff. And to be honest, when I met the team and realized, wow, we got some talent here. This guy, Mark Matthews, he's pretty good, you know? And so that comfort level and the support that Peg Bradley Dobbs promised me and followed up with is just so. So yes, comfort was a word that I would use in both those situations, but there's a different meaning in both.
You talk about your move from Princeton to Denver. Lacrosse has come a long way in westward expansion, and in Colorado, it's booming and it has been for a while. What have you seen in your time as the Denver head coach and living in Denver and being an ambassador for the sport there in the growth? What have been some of the biggest factors?
Well, I'd say, you know, we probably get too much credit here, but one of the decisions we made that Trevor and Brownie and I made when I first got here was we're going to form a club program. And we formed a Denver Elite Club program, and it thrived because there were young men who now could have the vision of playing on a Division I team that could be in NCAA tournaments and had the goal of national championships and wanted to be around DU and wanted to be around the coaches who coached those kids. And so we quickly picked up a lot of really good players, which I'm also proud of the fact that other people formed club teams here and do a great job because it shows how much talent there is here in Denver. You know, when I first got to Princeton, I had a young man named Chris McHugh, who was a sophomore at the time. He was from Denver. And for all my years at Princeton, I had lunch like a couple of weeks ago with Christian Cook, who was a first team All-American, a world team player. And all those years at Princeton, we had Colorado guys, but it was one here, one there, one here, one there. So I think the club thing helped. Matt Brown and one of his partners formed the U.S. Box LA. Box lacrosse in our country has been underserved or undercoached or understood, if there is such a word. And by Matt forming that, it's now become nationwide. They've just struck a deal with USA Lacrosse to be the leader of U.S. Box. And I'm telling you, and I've said it, you can look back because I had the opportunity. I didn't know what I was doing, but in 1974, the original NLL came to a club game. I was playing on Long Island Lacrosse Club, and my best friend Ray Rostand was playing on Oyster Bay Lacrosse Club. And these guys came in and said, hey, we're looking for some American players this summer to come play box. I had no job. I was teaching at a Catholic school, you know, for $6,000 a year. And so we went off and it for 2 years, you know, that was a great league. It was a lot of fun, basically. But it also made me appreciate box lacrosse and the Canadians. So now I get out here and I'm with Matt Brown, who was won many Minto Cups, was a, you know, box player in the NLL. It just took off from there as far as our box stuff and what he has done with the CCBL, which is our college box league, and just throughout the country to have so many kids playing both sports. Now it's become a regular thing for American kids, and not just what we used to call box was playing in a gym. And maybe if you had some nets, you'd drop them down, but still use the big goal and all that stuff. So with those combinations of things, with my batteries being recharged, with the club lacrosse, with Brownie's box lacrosse, with the support we had at DU, it just made sense for this opportunity. If you've ever been to a game here, the atmosphere at Peter Barton Stadium is out of control. It's, you know, little kids, big kids, parents, adults, recruits, players, you know, from all over the place. And it's quite a scene. And so it's just like anything else that's supported in the right way. It just continued to grow. And I'd like to think that we helped the westward expansion, I wouldn't say whether it was certainly not the only reason. And I'm happy to see that Utah has come in, you know, and what those guys have done there is just nothing short of amazing. So, you know, Brian Holman, who was on my first staff at Hopkins, you know, started this thing at Utah, and Coach McMinn now has continued that. And it's so cool to see.
You made no secret when you announced that this would be your last season that you very much wanted Matt Brown to be your successor. And that has come to fruition. Announced a couple of weeks ago that Coach Brown will take over the reins starting, you know, next season for the Denver Pioneers. How important was that for Denver lacrosse? I understand there's a process in place and university had to undergo the process. Coach Brown gets the job. You know, how important was it that Matt Brown became the next head coach of Pioneer Lacrosse?
Well, to give you a little background, Mark, I have one more year on my contract. So had that not come to fruition, I might have put the brakes on and put it in reverse and said, no, you can't hire that guy. I'm still a coach here and I got one more year on my contract. There was no doubt, no doubt. And I give Josh Berlow, RAD, a lot of credit. He went through a process. To be honest, Brownie had a couple of months of anxiety there, but it also made Brownie better. It made him, you know, reconfigure his thoughts, because you have to change from an associate head coach to being a head coach. You know, I'll change my verbiage, but one thing I always tell young assistant coaches is you go from talking about the idiot to being the idiot once you move from assistant to head coach. And so that's the biggest step. But this guy, Matt Brown, it's ridiculous. The guy is so smart. He's so good. He's such a good person. He's so, so good at like planning practices, having game plans, coaching the kids in a much better way than I do. That it was just, it was in my mind, it was ridiculous to even think about anybody else. Certainly understood the process of it all. And to be honest, taking this time and having them now named at the right time has really been a part of our recent success, to be honest with you.
Coach, you talk about Matt Brown's qualities as a coach, and he's been with you for a long time. At what point did you realize that not only was he, you know, destined to be a head coach somewhere, but he was the right guy at Denver? Like, I mean, was it years ago, you know, when, and you knew this day was coming, that someday you'd retire. So just curious.
Yeah, it's interesting. Again, I keep breaking things down into twos here. When I got hired, you know, I only took the job if they promised me that Trevor could be my associate head coach. And they promised me that right away. Back then, 14 years ago, I thought Trevor was going to stay in coaching. And so like, you know, Matt and John Donowski, the assumption would be that it would roll into whatever day it was that Trevor would be the next head coach. Well, you know, I knew Trevor for a lot of years. You know, he lived in my house for a lot of years. And what I knew about Trevor was that he was a guy that always had different goals. When he would focus on one goal and do it unbelievably so. I mean, this is a guy who has a psychology degree from Princeton University, a master's from Harvard in developmental psych, and now is working in construction management. So this guy goes from one thing to another, and at some point after we won our championship and he had his sights set on working in this developmental psych thing, working with companies and teams and everything else, he felt like that was more what he wanted to do, and that was fine. So immediately, Matt Brown moves up into the associate head coach. That was probably the time, so 2016, 2017, where I started to really notice that Matt was head coach material. But I'll go back to 2009, the summer when I was hired. I told Matt, because he told Trevor he would like to stay. He was on the staff here. And I told him that I was going to talk to some people. And then within a day, I received a note from Matt describing every player that was still on the team, telling me who to keep and who to get rid of, what he was doing with the guys that were still around. And at that point, I knew his the most important part of it was his passion and love for DU was gonna be something special. And so I called him the next day and I said, forget about it. I'm not going outwards. You are my second assistant coach. And so in two ways, number one, what he did helped me decide this, I wanted this guy on my staff. And then number two, being with him for 6 or 7 years when we won the championship and Trevor moving out, by then I had realized this guy is going to not only just be a great offensive coordinator, but be a great head coach. And then since then, has really, really, honestly, at times I feel like more times now than not, that he's been running this program for the last few years. And so one of the things I've learned over the years is, as I talked about it before, is to understand that it doesn't matter what 6-on-5 drill you do. You know, if someone's got a decent idea, then go with it and let your assistant coaches fly a little bit. And Matt had more than one great idea over the years. And I think that went back to Freddie Smith's belief in me with that one little thing we did at Hopkins. You know, since then, Matt is just the recruiting, that the recruits he got us, the Canadian kids he got us, the way he coached them, offensively, obviously a genius, you know, and as was Metzi at Princeton for me. Without those two guys, you're talking to somebody who probably would have got fired 30 years ago. So, you know, it's just been amazing. And he deserved this. He's going to run with this. He's going to make it even better than it is and was. And so I'm so excited to watch him grow and watch the program continue with great success.
Incredible backdrop, Coach. As we now turn our attention a little bit more toward the current day, you know, 2023, how would you best characterize Denver's season up to this point, entering the Big East semifinals this coming in a couple of days against Villanova?
I'd say, and now that I've had time to contemplate that, Mark, I would say unsurprising in light of all the things we just talked about. Unsurprising that, you know, these kids, you know, I asked them not to, but, you know, with the quality young men that we have here at DU, and, you know, we just got we're a trimester here, so we're in midterms right now. Everybody else is graduating. We're in midterms right now for the third time this year. Unsurprising that these guys have dedicated so much, even though I didn't want them to my happiness, even though, you know, they've seen me at my worst more often than at my best. But so unsurprising early season craziness, ups and downs, from you know, being a minute short of beating Duke, and to their credit, because they're so well coached, they pulled that one out. And I'm sure they feel like they're playing better now than they did then, as does every team. So unsurprising in that level, and yet maybe unsurprising that we lost to Air Force, you know. And so those have been the extremes. Obviously, our wins at North Carolina, over Ohio State, certainly over Villanova, which was our best game by far. The first time around, you know, the other night against Marquette, if there's a better four in whatever team in the country, I don't want to see them, because Marquette is going to be really good. But so, and yet, when it all kind of started settling in, unsurprising that our guys have responded and won 5 games in a row and 6 of our last 7, and unsurprising that they have been so supportive, unsurprising that they play so well, unsurprising that they've reacted in strange situations. We put them in a really tough spot a few weeks ago, you know, when we played Towson at Towson on a Thursday night, and then drove to New York, you know, 5-hour bus ride, and played St. John's the following day, and didn't play well. But in both those situations, we had to protect the lead. That's a learning experience. We had to come back in the St. John's game. That's a learning experience. And then last week we had to win an overtime game. That's a learning experience. But none of that is surprising to me, because It's been so erratic. We're certainly not the most talented team in the country, but I think the one thing people forget about Denver, I laugh when I read some of this stuff that, oh yeah, you know, how is a mediocre Denver team ranked ninth in the country at this point? It may be true. It may not be true. I don't know. I don't do that stuff. But what I do know is that for the last 10 years, we've traveled over 30,000 miles a year. And some of these guys that refused to come out to Denver to play us for one trip for 2,000 miles or one trip for a round trip of 3,000 miles, I laugh because we've averaged eight cross-country trips a year. And so with all of that in mind, the season has been certainly memorable, some really high highs, some amazing experiences with what they've given me. And yet, you know, here we are. We're in the exact same situation that we were in a year ago and many years here. We're going into a semifinal for the Big East against a great Villanova team. So a lot has changed, but nothing's changed.
When you look at this year's team, you don't see a scorer who jumps out at you like a Wesley Bird, Mark Matthews, Ethan Walker type guy with those kind of stats, but you do see balance. It's like, I think your top six scorers are all between 24 and 35 points. Who are some of your leaders on this year's team?
Matt Brown. That, you know, I was looking at a film of last year's Villanova playoff game. And for the most of the game, five of the six offensive players are gone. And so to take what was left, our second midfield is now our first midfield. Just some of these guys. Michael Lampert is 5 foot nothing, 100 and nothing pounds, is now playing attack for us. We made a switch with he and Noah Manning. But basically, it's just the six, same six guys with our attack and our first midfield on there. We've played depth with six more middies. We got people playing on our midfield that others laughed at when we even recruited them. And so how does this all come together? It all comes together. And you're right, Dan, we don't have Ethan Walker. We don't have Wesley Bird. And so you never know. Richie Connell overnight became a feeder all of a sudden this year. The guy who probably had five assists in his whole career became a feeder because of his adjustment, the adjustments that Matt's made for him. So with that in mind, I can imagine that other coaches sit in their offices watching film and go, these guys suck. We don't have to slide to any of them. We don't have to worry about Ethan Walker putting in a coffee can from 20 yards out. We got this. And then all of a sudden, Stephen Avery has seven goals in one game. Nick Kelly has 3-2 the other night. Richie has 4-2. We've had JJ has probably, Silstrup's been our most consistent guy. And this is the first year he's ever been healthy. And so, staff battles. People can say these other guys are the greatest face-off guys in the country, and they are. They're fabulous players out there. But Stath is a warrior. He gets mad at me if I take him out of practice. He plays on our scout team's defense every day. And this guy is just, he's carried our team. And so all of a sudden you get a couple of goals here from some poles because Brownie's, who's in charge of our clearing game, it gives them free rein to go if they got to go. We get goals from all sorts of different guys. Mikey Lampert's flying through the air and scoring a goal or two a game, and getting assists two games ago. And so it's really been maybe those same coaches who say, we don't have to slide to these guys or these guys aren't very good, have a big butt. Like, and I don't mean a big butt. I mean a BUT butt, saying, but they can all do something. What are they going to do? And that's why I said Matt Brown at first, because what he does in figuring stuff out in a matter of days is beyond my experience and my thought. That's for sure. And so it's been a team effort. We knew it was going to be this year. We had some experience at the defensive end and It's just been one trial after another after another after another. But here we are in that situation, playing Villanova in the semifinals of the Big East tournament.
You matched up with the Wildcats back on April 8th, a game that you guys won 12-6 early in the conversation. You said that was your best game of the year for the Denver Pioneers. What needs to happen this Thursday in Milwaukee to get another win over Villanova?
Maybe for them not to show up. I'm not really sure, but we played really well defensively. John Gallant had a great game plan for that game, and it was just one of those days. It was one of those days that that just happened. I don't expect it'll be 12-6. It's going to be a war, and so what's got to happen is that you got to protect against certain things. There, Matt Campbell is first team All-American in my book, and the Daly kid in front of the goal, he scores. If he gets his stick on the ball, it's going in the back of the net. And then what they have that other people don't, some other people don't have, is a supporting cast that if you dare think that, oh, we'll cover this guy with a short stick, or we won't slide to that guy, you're in for a rough day. And so they are really good offensively. They're coached so well, and they know who they are. They have no qualms about being the Villanova for the last, certainly from in my estimation, the last 14 years. They just change the pieces, and they go out there and they play their butts off. They play hard, they play clean. They're just a great group. And the kid in the goal has been a 5-year starter, and he's given us fits over the years.
Coach, we're so appreciative of your time. I have a couple more questions. We've been asking all the coaches this year to bring this one home. One of the really fun parts about working in a college athletic department is making those relationships with other coaches, getting to know other student athletes. What is one particular team at DU that you love to go watch play?
Well, there's a lot. I'll backdrop that a little bit with what a lot of people don't know is there's a national championship of athletic departments. It's called the Learfield Cup. And it's got different levels, kind of like Division I, Division II, Division III, but it's Division I has two or three different levels. And we're in the second level because we don't have football here. University of Denver's athletic department has won 14 of the last 15 Learfield Cups, national championships of athletic departments. So when you start asking for one, I can tell you that almost every program here has been in national championships. Obviously, our hockey program is at the forefront of our athletic department, and rightfully so. They put 6,500 people in the stands 18 times a year. Our coaches have gone on to be professional coaches. We have had the youngest head coach in Division I hockey in David Carl. Thankfully, he's still here and hopefully signed on for a long, long time. But our gymnastics program just made it to the Final Eight. They've been in Final Fours. Our women's lacrosse team is undefeated right now in Division I lacrosse. And what they're going through is kind of what we went through 12 years ago when people didn't believe. Well, they've beaten Boston College. They've beaten Maryland, and then this week they drop in the rankings from third to fifth and they're undefeated. Like, I don't know how that happens, but everything that we go to, everything, our soccer team, our men's soccer team has been in the Final Four. So everything that we go to, you kind of like, you realize that, and it was a lot like Princeton for me, the competitiveness, friendly competitiveness, the drive you have here is to just keep up with these guys. It's just an amazing, amazing athletic program, and it's an amazing place out here in Denver. And I think that's one of the things I'm going to miss the most, and is that our athletic program is just every season is people doing something better than you thought they could do, and all of them, committed to excellence, and all of them have a common bond, and that's my friend Nico Blankenship as our SID, and that has brought us together. You know, we have TV games, we have radio games. This is a big time program, and yet because lacrosse is located where you guys are, in general, the heartbeat of lacrosse is in Baltimore, out east certainly. A lot of people either don't know, refuse to know, or, you know, will never believe. But it's an amazing, amazing place.
All right, last question, Coach. Denver is a really good food town. What are your favorite restaurants to frequent?
My favorite restaurant is 4 miles east of here when I go home at night, because I'm married to the best cook in the world. And we don't go to restaurants. I can't tell you how many times I've asked Helen for her birthday or for Valentine's Day or for Mother's Day. Hey, wait, you know, let's go out. Let's go have dinner. I'm making this for dinner. You know, like, there's just two of us here, you know? It would be not right for me to even try to compare any great restaurant to what I get at home every day. It's amazing.
That's the best answer we've ever gotten, Dixie. No other person has ever went that route, Coach. And I sincerely appreciate that. And you are a lucky man.
No doubt.
Okay. Coach, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for all you do for the sport and being a supporter of not only us, but Inside Lacrosse. And best of luck to the Pioneers in the postseason.
Well, thanks, Dan. Thanks, Mark. You know, we enjoy what you guys do. And, you know, it's our world. And we talked about, you asked about it earlier, Dan. This world of lacrosse has changed so much. But it's because of guys like you that have, I know you're not signing million-dollar contracts, you know, and what has happened in our sport at the professional level, the coverage. You know, I go back to my friend Sean Bratches, who played for me at RIT, who was such an inspiration for ESPN and John Vassallo to take this thing on and do it the right way. And now you're looking at hundreds of games, streamed games, and you know, maybe someday I'll be sitting on doing some podcasts with you guys. So we'll see what happens in our future here, but I'm not going anywhere, except I won't be the head coach at the University of Denver. So thank you for what you guys do, and thanks to everybody else in our lacrosse world for all they do, because the sacrifice that you guys all make from your families for our families is second to none. So thank you.
Thanks, Coach. Man, that was great talking to him.
It was. And we've waited, you know, throughout the season. We always knew we wanted to get Coach Tierney on. And boy, it was great to catch up with him. Great to talk with him.
He's the GOAT in many ways. I mean, his success on the field certainly speaks for itself, but just an ambassador of the game, great human being, funny, and real generous with his time, always, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's get to these games. It's important. Georgetown, Providence, Denver, Villanova.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the weather in Milwaukee. If you're going to go out there, you know, what are we looking at? So Thursday, high of 60, low of 48. Friday, 62, low of 46. Saturday, 59, low of 47. Not too shabby. And it looks like there might be some cloud cover, but not rain, which is good. So when you look at the Big East, very interesting. How many bids will this league get? When you look at the RPI, Georgetown is 8, Denver 11, Villanova 12. Is it a situation where if these teams lose in the conference semifinals, that's it? Or do, you know, these teams need to advance to the championship to get NCAA consideration if they don't win the championship?
Is Georgetown a lock for the tournament?
I don't think so. You know, RPI of 8, which is great. But then you look at the wins, and that's if they don't win the Big East championship. Let me caveat that. You know, their two best wins are over Denver and Villanova. They also have a win over Princeton, which could increase in value depending upon how the Tigers do this weekend in the Ivy League. But I think, you know, Kevin Warren and the Hoyas are going to feel a whole lot better about themselves if they can just outright win the Big East championship, which would be their fourth in a row, by the way, if they are able to do so.
Dynasty. Yeah, I see this as if Georgetown wins the semifinal game, whoever they play in the championship game, I think each of those teams gets in.
You're probably, you know, you could be right. You know, again, it depends on what happens in other conferences.
That's true.
You know, this has always been a bracket buster, if you will, when Denver's been the favorite to go and they've got the credentials, you know, even if they didn't win the Big East championship to go to the NCAA tournament. Georgetown was that one that would like steal bids, you know, and make it a two bid league. And you got to give a lot of credit to Bobby Benson, first year head coach at Providence. He's got the Friars in the Big East tournament. They scored, you know, a couple wins down the stretch that secured them that opportunity. And then when Denver beat Marquette in you know, last weekend, that sealed the deal for the Friars to get into the Big East tournament. So great conference, you know, really fun conference. And then you got Villanova, like the team that, you know, I always call Rutgers kind of the Rodney Dangerfield of college lacrosse, you know, that people talk about. I think that Villanova is that team that no one really talks about, but is always year in and year out a pretty quality product with some really good players.
Let's move on to Friday's games. And it starts in the Atlantic Sun. The semifinals are going to be held at Robert Morris, predetermined site in Moon Township, Pennsylvania. Great name for a town, Moon Township.
It does always catch my attention.
In the first game of the day, this game's at 1 o'clock, top seed Utah finished 9-0 in that league against a really grueling travel schedule. We'll play number four, Bellarmine. And then the second game, Air Force, who earned the number two seed, will play number six seeded Robert Morris at 4 o'clock.
Yeah, how about Bobby Moe upsetting, ending the Dolphins season? You know, a Jacksonville team that was ranked in the inside lacrosse top 20 consistently, really the top 15 for a while, and has a win over Duke. You know, so kind of a disappointing finish for Jacksonville, but still a program on the rise. But you know, Robert Morris is the team that beat Utah last year, and that is Andrew McMinn's old stomping grounds, now the head coach of the Utah Utes. They'll take on Bellarmine, who's been a great, you know, story this year in 2023. Their head coach, Andrew Whitley, doing a great job, you know, getting them more success. And they knocked off Mercer in the quarterfinals of the Atlantic Sun. And then you have an Air Force team that, you know, has surprised a lot of people, including Denver this year. So the Falcons, very capable. Another one bid league, but the tournament will be a lot of fun. And we'll see if the visitors can overcome the Moon Township home field advantage of the Colonials.
Patriot League semifinals will take place at top seeded Boston University in Boston, Mass. Number one, BU, will play first on Friday at 4 o'clock. They will play Loyola, coming off of their win over Navy. And in the second game, number two seeded Army will play number three seed Lehigh at 7. Dix, I know what the metrics say, but this feels like two teams should come out of this and go to the NCAA tournament. What's your take on this league?
I mean, it's a league that's nine deep, and they beat each other up. It's good lacrosse. It's quality lacrosse. But, you know, BU is sitting at 13 right now in the RPI. Is that enough if they don't win the Patriot League championship to get them an at-large? I'm just not so sure, because other than Loyola, there's really nobody with quality wins. You know, Loyola owns a top five and a top 10 win in the RPI. But they're 8-7, you know, and sitting 31st in the RPI. So I think Loyola has that best argument, you know, to get the at-large, but that's a stretch. You know, Army's at 19 in the RPI. Lehigh's at 24. So I do feel like, as much as I'd love to say two Patriot League teams are going to make this thing, you know, I do think the champion of the league will be the only one, you know, that goes to the big dance. You know, Boston beat Loyola a few weeks back handily at Nickerson. You know, the Greyhounds, again, impressive effort against Navy on Tuesday night, 12-7. They were up 7-1 at half. Luke Stout was great in goal, 18 saves. Evan James, six goals. So two primetime players really stepped up for the Greyhounds. Army Lehigh, it's a rematch of a March 18th game, won by Army, 12-10. And then we had Joe Aparicio on the program last week, and, you know, just a team, you know, a true team getting the job done. But they stubbed their toes a little bit, you know, losing the season finale and then therefore getting the number two seed, the BU. And Lehigh, you know, Patriot League Offensive Player of the Year, Scott Cole, has been a wrecking ball. What do you have, seven goals against Loyola last Friday night? He had another hat trick in the quarterfinal victory over Lafayette on Tuesday. So this will be a really fun night on Friday night. All those games are on CBS Sports Network as well.
And rounding out the conference tournaments is the Ivy League. The semifinals are held at Columbia University, a neutral site in New York. Cornell earned the number one seed with an overtime win over Princeton last week. Number one Cornell plays number four Yale, who got in an elimination game more or less with Harvard. So Yale plays Cornell. That's at 6 o'clock on Friday. These games are on ESPNU. And then in the nightcap, number two Penn plays number three seed Princeton at 8:30.
Here we go again with the Ivy League. You know, 3 weeks ago, this league is looking like a one bid league, and that was Cornell. But now you have the Big Red sitting at 7 in the RPI, Yale 9, Penn 10, and Princeton at 17. So all are in the top. You know, we've got three teams in the top 10 and one team in the top 20 for the RPI. And the RPI is only going to get better after this weekend. Wow. How do you handicap this thing? I'm not really sure. Anything can happen. I mean, this is a Yale team that gave up 20-plus goals in successive weekends to Cornell and Princeton, but they've gotten it together lately and are playing really good lacrosse. Penn is that team that everybody seems to want to bag on because they're always around that 500 mark, but they play such a good schedule. And they had to come from behind to beat Albany in a midweek game last week. They had trouble with the Danes. You know, the Danes are playing some really good lacrosse right now. So I think that potentially this could be a two-bid league, potentially. And I think I'm looking at the Ivies and the Big East as the two that could either just be their champion or it could also be the runner-up, you know. So it's between the Ivies and the Big East to get, you know, either one bid or multiple bids, I think.
Great action. Find your favorite teams. Get in front of a TV, get out to a game, get your tickets. Lots of fun action this weekend. All right, it's time for the give and go. And I'd like to welcome into the show Bruce Donaldson. Bruce is the president and CEO of Simplicity Group, a friend of the pod. Thanks for joining us, Bruce.
Great to be here. Really enjoy your work, Dan and Mark. It's awesome.
Bruce, you have a lifetime journey in the sport of lacrosse, including playing and coaching internationally in England and Australia, and played professionally in the NLL. Can you share with us some of those adventures and where this love of the sport comes from?
Oh, the love of the sport's easy. Anybody who's ever picked up a stick or thrown a ball against the wall or got to compete or take out their frustrations on defense, you know, knows it's the best game there is. I was very fortunate after college to be asked to go over to England to develop the sport there. So it was really, you know, went from being a, you know, college knucklehead playing lacrosse to being an American ambassador for the game in, you know, what was a rural part, really in a brown belt industrial area around Sheffield, England, where, People were looking for an outlet, and it's amazing. You get a group of kids, you put a stick in their hand, you teach them just the basics of what the game is, and you watch them fall in love with it because it is such an awesome game. And had a ton of experiences while I was over in England. I didn't think it could get any better than that. And then was playing, as so many, all the cross guys know, the network that you develop and the connections that you make are awesome. But I was literally sitting in a pub on New Year's Day after playing, all day tournament in Manchester. And a guy walks up to me. He's got hair down to his butt. He looked like Jesus. He's in. It's January in Manchester, England, which is an answer for cold. And he's in flip flops. He's got long hair, baggy shorts. And he's like, "Mate, you should come down to Australia and play lacrosse." And it turned out that guy was Gordon Purdy, who was, I think he played like CW Post or whatever. And it was just that was the way the world worked back then. If you had a lacrosse stick and could drink a beer, you got a lot of opportunities open up for you. And that brought me to Australia, which was a very different experience. But to see the game played down, down under, and the things that it opened up was really awesome. So I was able to travel the world on my lacrosse stick for 2 years, despite my parents' warnings that wasn't going to last very long. So.
Hey, so Bruce, I got a couple things for you. I played with Gordon in Vail a couple years. He's an Adelphi guy. I'm just going to throw that out there.
That's right. I'm already in trouble with my Long Island crowd. Yeah,
I don't want him coming after you. Gordon's a great guy, but I too had the opportunity to play lacrosse in England. It was only for 10 days when I was back at Johns Hopkins. Every class, every 4 years, you got a trip, and ours was England in the summer of 1993, and we were playing against the English because they were trying to determine their national team for the World Games that following summer in 1994. So we went to Bath. It was our first stop, and we played a game there. And then we went to Manchester and we played three games in Manchester. And then we ended up in London after our lacrosse was over. But we had a blast, man. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can't imagine how they, with the drinking age at like 16, if there is a drinking age in England, how your coaches kind of kept you under wraps. But that's interesting. Because we the collection of coaches that were over there in 88, they used us as the USA All-Stars to practice against the English national team for the selection. So sounds like we trod a lot of the same ground, and a lot of fun over there. The passion, the quality of play night may not be the same, but the passion is equal for sure. It's just weird going into the locker room with the English team, and they're all smoking cigarettes at halftime or whatever. It's like, really, we can't beat these guys? But they were great. They were good players.
My host was Steve Morley. I don't know if you ever knew Steve.
Geez. He was a cop. I played with him up in Sheffield. Yep.
Great guy. Lost touch with him, unfortunately, but maybe this conversation I could reach out to him. But great guy. And I'll never forget, England beat us in the first game. And they treated it like they won the championship, and we were just treating it as an exhibition. So the next two games were battles. And I can remember, one of our best players was Terry Reardon, who's Irish, and he had a shamrock. I remember Terry scored like 7 or 8 goals in one game, and he'd run over to the crowd and point to his shamrock and pat himself on the back with the lacrosse stick. That went over real well with the hooligans. That was fun.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So, Bruce, you're president, CEO of Simplicity Group. How have some of the lessons that you've learned from lacrosse helped you in your business career?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. When I started out, I was nobody's answer for a great athlete. The thing that I've always loved about lacrosse is that, with the stick, you can be tactical, you can outthink opponents. There's a thousand different ways to compete successfully in lacrosse. So, having, a slow start to my career, which ultimately took me to the indoor league and playing professionally, which was really the pinnacle, that came from just, hard work and dedication and really just never quitting. And I think those attributes, those were lessons that I learned successfully from playing lacrosse. Playing in the indoor league, in the late 80s and early 90s was awesome. But the only way I got there was just, you know, I just kept at it. I just never stopped. I always wanted it. Didn't have that success early, but stayed with it. Getting overseas was great. And then when I came back to the U.S., you know, was lucky enough to get into the league. And you know, we had, you know, had my welcome to the league moment, which is an interesting story. But, you know, the way I got there was just never stopping. And I think, you know, I like you guys, you coach kids in sports. And one of the things I see in today's game is, you know, I think that the change to the early recruiting has mitigated this a little bit. But a lot of times our kids get to ninth grade or 10th grade and they're like, oh, I'm not going to go to Hopkins or UVA. Like, oh, I got to do something else. And it's like, guys, you have no idea the potential you have if you just stay with it. Yeah, so you're playing on the JV team for another year, whatever that issue is. If you set a goal and you never stop and you use your mind, not just your body, to try and get where you're going, it's amazing what you can accomplish. And I would say, you know, with simplicity, we've been lucky enough to recruit a lot of very like-minded partners, you know, like lacrosse back in the day. We have some really interesting personalities. That's one of the joys of being in this partnership. But what everybody has in common is they're very competitive and they just don't stop until they accomplish their goal. And I would say that was probably the biggest lesson for me that I learned long before I went to England, Australia, or played in the league. That's how I got there. That's not the lesson that I learned.
I know you're a proponent of growing the game, you know, just in general, in any way possible. And so are we. So we've talked about this several times, and I love maybe opening up a can of worms, but when it comes to improving the product of college lacrosse and the experience for players and fans alike, one topic that often is discussed is shifting the spring schedule back a little bit. For instance, why can't Memorial Day weekend be the first weekend of the tournament? Why do we have to sit outside in the freezing cold in February with 200 fans, or have games moved because it's too cold to play in February, and just start the season, say, March 1st, have a hard start date of March 1st, and just play the NCAAs into June. You know, when, you know, from Dixie's broadcasting side, there's a lot more TV windows that open up after college basketball ends. I throw this out there to you two to get your thoughts on how to solve this problem.
I think the challenges, Dan, are logistical in nature. I know baseball does it, but how far into the summer do they go? I'm not opposed to it, because that would mean pushing the season back, meaning instead of starting your games in the first weekend in February, you know, you're starting maybe the last week of February. So I think those are positives. I just try to think of it from the logistics side of things, the housing of student athletes that don't live off campus, the food situation, those kinds of things. I like what you're saying. The other thing is, it also bleeds into summer when fans and players, parents, you know, are going on vacation, or in this climate, you know, shuttling their kids to tournaments. You know, that starts the summer circuit for both youth and high school tournaments. So I do think it's a worthwhile exploration, but I think, you know, playing devil's advocate, those would be some of the roadblocks that you would experience if you tried to do that.
Yeah. So Dan, this is something I've thought about for a long time is, you know, it seems to me, and I don't know, and maybe Mark does because he's in TV, that, you know, ESPN back in the day, they latched onto the idea that, you know, as a counter to the Indianapolis 500, we needed to have something we could put on Memorial Day. And it was almost an afterthought of how we got anchored around that. Because back when I was growing up, which is probably a little earlier than you guys, that was, you know, the game wasn't on TV the way it became. To me, I think it's a mistake. I don't think you're ever going to get an upstate New York guy to admit that he's afraid of getting on blacktop in February because the fields are frozen over, that, you know, that you can't play the game, because that's how I grew up playing it. And I think a lot of, you know, the north of the Mason-Dixon guys, Dixon line guys would be fine with that. But the reality is, if you think about where this game should go, and Coach Tierney, you know, him moving to Denver really started opening up some hotbeds now, Texas, Colorado, California. You know, that happened because the game is great and people are becoming aware of it. But the fact that, you know, still, even as an old, you know, indoor guy or professional guy, the men's college game is really the marquee sport. And depriving people of the opportunity to see teams once the weather gets good, because the game is different. If you're playing in April, it's one thing. If you're playing in February, it's just a different game. You're trying to survive in February when that 6 foot stick's coming down on you, as opposed to April where the game really opens up and gets beautiful. So just saying that this weekend is the last weekend for all but 12 teams seems like a massive mistake to me. And by extending the TV schedule, and whether you're doing a kickoff, you know, the start of the season and Memorial Day weekend, you can solve that from a contract perspective. But I think the quality of lacrosse goes up, the exposure goes up, and the fact that kids are also going to tournaments and probably in the same towns where they're hosting a quarterfinal, like, that's going to draw more fans into the stadium. And I just think it becomes, you know, reinforcing. And then ultimately, I think what you'll see on the men's side is an increase of the number of Division I men's program to get equivalence with, you know, the women's side, which has really taken off. We all know the reasons why the women's game teams have grown. But I think the more we can get the sport in its spring or summer level, where the quality of play is arguably better, on TV, in stadiums, I think that's going to – the game sells itself. We don't need to sell it. We can talk about it. The game sells itself. It's just that exposure, I think, would really grow the game a lot.
Well said, Bruce. I think the pros outweigh the cons, and the opportunities outweigh the challenges. And we need to get this done. Lacrosse gods, whoever you are, make these decisions.
I think, Bruce, you bring up a lot of great points. One thing that you kind of jogged my thought process: what if there's a partnership with the PLL in terms of the NCAA tournament? I mean, that could be some red tape, but, you know, that's where the windows are now with lacrosse in the summertime on ESPN is the PLL.
But, you know, to me, look, I wasn't sure what was happening when that came out and the evolution of the pro game. But you want to talk about a forward thinking group. And I'm not a social media guy, but they've embraced social media, you know, for better or for worse. They've been creative around lining up their sponsorship, the documentaries they've done. Like, I think that they would embrace that because, hey, guess what? When the draft comes and these guys that were just playing in the NCAAs, they have already got their, you know, Redwoods uniform or, you know, Atlas uniform. They can't play yet because they're finishing out their season. I just think all of that stuff starts compounding. I'm sure the Rebels would be on board with that. And I ultimately think, and I don't know, Mark, you're the TV guy, but it seems like a lot of this is driven by the dollars associated with TV. And I understand that that's super important. And the lacrosse gods, to your point, Dan, it probably in this case is the NCAA. And I don't think that's anybody's answer to perfect management. Like, it's you and I and everybody who's vested in the growth of the game that should be dictating how it should be done, not what's optimal for the NCAA in terms of sequencing so they get their max, because they probably don't want to cut across the college baseball World Series. Well, I got a newsflash for them. 20 years from now, people are going to be talking about not the college World Series, but the lacrosse quarterfinals and semifinals. Because anybody who's ever played those two sports, and no disrespect to your son, Dan, I hope he does come back to a stick. But, like, once you play it forever. And that's what's great about the game. We just need to open that up.
I think that is a perfect ending to that conversation. I do want to get – I've created a game for you guys, quick game for the give and go. You know, this weekend, I've said it many times, I think that this Thursday and Friday – are the two best days of the lacrosse season. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples from different sports. I'll name the sport, and then I'll give you a, you know, so it'll be two events within the same sport, and I want to get your opinion, what you guys think is better. So we'll start with NCAA Lacrosse Conference weekend, this weekend or the first weekend of the NCAA tournament of men's lacrosse? Which is better?
I think this weekend is the best, just because you got four teams going in. Interleague play is awesome. And the you know, as hard as it can be, and I'm a lacrosse parent, as hard as it can be to see, you know, the prospect of the season ends for everybody, right? That's a fact of life. And there is nothing better than seeing how people perform when it's all on the line. And the fact that you've got more teams. Hey, look, I didn't think I was getting on a podcast and talking about Moon Township. Hey, we're dialed in on Moon Township this weekend. And can Romo, you know, take that over? I think it's awesome. I think that's great. But that you know, Dixie, what do you think?
Bruce, I'm going to agree with you. Look, I love the NCAA tournament. It's incredible. But that first round, lacrosse isn't where college basketball is in terms of the number of upsets that you may have in the first round or two, the first weekend of the NCAA men's basketball tournament. So typically, the NCAA men's lacrosse tournament first round goes chalk. You know, the conference tournaments, there's that fight to get to the NCAA tournament, so it can be a little bit more competitive. And as such, you know, us at the Big Ten Network, we televise the quarterfinals, semifinals, and the final of that conference's championship. But also, if you look at ESPN, they've picked up more games in terms of conference tournament. This weekend, you'll be able to enjoy the Ivy League semifinals and championships, the MAC championship, the America East championship. So they've expanded, you know, ESPN has expanded their coverage of conference tournaments due to that level of excitement. And oh, by the way, CBS Sports Network, they got you covered with the Big East tournament as well as the Patriot League tournament. So, you know, television recognizes the competitiveness and the intensity of this weekend, of the conference championship weekend.
All right. So again, your task is same sport, different event. This weekend is also the Kentucky Derby, first weekend in May. So which event, in your opinion, is better, the Preakness or the Belmont?
Preakness all day long. Preakness.
Are you an inside the track guy, Mark? Are you one of those fancy guys up in the stands away from the mayhem?
I've been to the Preakness, Bruce, once, and that was enough. And I was on the infield for sure. And it was, I'll never forget it too, because it was 19, I think it was either 96 or 97. And I had a good time. I had a very good time. And this was before the internet, right at the, you know, precipice of the internet and social media and that kind of thing. But our good friends, John Haas and Todd Cavallaro, were coaching at Washington College, and they beat Salisbury in the Division III NCAA tournament that day. And I remember getting home and seeing that result, and I was feeling no pain. And I called Cavi, and back then we didn't have cell phones, so it was his office at Washington College that I called, leaving this probably 4-minute rambling message congratulating him on beating Salisbury in the NCAA tournament. So Preakness all day, man. I'm a Baltimore guy. Also, it's, you know, hope springs eternal, because the Derby winner, you hope, can win the Preakness. And it's also a more intimate setting. I mean, Belmont looks like a, you know, it looks like a mansion compared to a nice, comfortable house. It's just so big. And the race is much longer, too, right? So I'll take the Preakness.
Yeah, that's easy for me. It's got to be the Preakness.
Yeah, the Preakness, just, as Mark said, you know, you can maybe see the Triple Crown winner making that second stage, but you know, that could end at the Preakness as well, and the Belmont kind of leaves that, takes that away from you. All right, same sport, different event in golf. British Open versus the Masters.
Wow. I'm gonna go British Open. Home of golf, better whiskey, frankly, you know, more accessible. I would say the British Open has done a great job of letting, you know, the guys like me who actually have to work for a living inside the tournament. It's not so exclusive that you can't get in. It hasn't become too corporate. Look, you can't debate the scenery of the Masters and the drama. And I remember watching Nicklaus roll that putt in, and what was it, 86 to come back when he was like 47. So I don't think you can beat the quality of the golf and the view and the made for TV thing. But if I had to go to one of the two, for sure, I'm going to the British Open. And while I may not remember who won, I'm going to have a great night in whatever pub is the Royal St. George's. I'm going to be there and have a good time. So, but that, and they were there. Nobody's letting me into the Masters. So maybe Dixie's getting into the Masters because, you know, he's a TV guy. They'll want him there, but I'm going British Open.
So this is an education for me because I'm not a golf guy. So if they're not letting you in, Bruce, they're sure as heck not letting me in, I bet. Again, not being a golf guy, just based on what I see, the visual, I would say Masters because it's typically nice weather. And you mentioned the scenery. And when the British Open is being played, I mean, it looks like it's miserable. Like it's typically windy and rainy and cold and yada, yada, yada. But for the reasons that you just put forth, it sounds like I'd be a British Open guy.
You would like it more, but it shocks me not at all that, you know, a below the Mason Dixon Hopkins guy is going to want the warm weather, you know, the nice arm guards. Yeah, don't hurt me too much. Whereas the upstate guys are like, look, we're born for this weather. So yeah, I get it. I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, I'm soft when it comes to weather. And as I get older, I get softer and softer.
We should have just played you in February and not April.
Dixie's like destined to live in Boca. Some point. Yeah.
All right. We have talked about that. We will be moving south at some point.
Next one.
You are south.
Further south.
Next one. The Super Bowl versus NFL championship weekend. When there's two games, AFC Championship.
Championship weekend all day long. Easy. Absolutely. That's maybe for some of the same reasons, and maybe it's because as a Buffalo Bills fan, you know, God team. The ultimate weekend never seems to work out, although I'm ever hopeful. But I think the drama, like the want of getting there, just like this weekend, the number of people who want to get to the show, how the show plays out. Yeah, people talk about that for a long time, but if you've ever played in the semis to get to the match, you know, you never forget what that's like. And so to me, it's more like the journey than the destination. It's the hard work. It's the ups and downs. Championship weekend all day long.
Yeah, I'm split on this one. And I don't know if you're going to go down this road, Dan, but I prefer, like, I'll have the opportunity and the privilege again of calling the NCAA lacrosse championships this year again for Westwood One on radio. That Saturday to me is always more fun than Championship Monday. But when it comes to the NFL, especially when the Ravens aren't playing, I'm not as interested. I'll still watch and I'm still interested. Fantasy football's over, so I'm not much of a gambler, so I don't really put a whole lot of money on it. But I would probably say Super Bowl for me, just simply because, you know, if I don't have a dog in the fight, I really, you know, I'm really not that interested.
I choose championship weekend. You get two games. They're usually played, they're on a home field. Usually there's some snow, weather, rain, something like that. And it's really the best football. When you get to the Super Bowl, it's a show. And
that's true.
Too much pageantry, the half times, 45 minutes, all that stuff.
All the slipping. The field this year was like a skating rink for those guys. Yeah.
The football is best in championship weekend. All right, last one. This is tennis, U.S. Open versus Wimbledon.
So when I was in England back in 93, Wimbledon was being played. I didn't make it there, but some of my teammates did. I would probably take Wimbledon because I really grew a deep appreciation for John McEnroe back in the day. And the first tennis matches I remember watching were him and Bjorn Borg. And you're rooting for McEnroe, not only because he's American, but he was sassy, to say the least. So that's where I really grew a deep appreciation for John McEnroe. So I would take Wimbledon over the U.S. Open.
Yeah, that's interesting because in our family, we grew up watching Wimbledon and I got family down that way. But probably for the same reasons around the golf thing, look, U.S. Open is raw. Right. Tennis is a really interesting game. It's one person versus another person. There's nowhere to hide. and you get to Flushing Meadow, and it's a slog to get out there, and it's New York, and it blah blah blah. But once you're there, like, it's on, and the fans that are there feel like they paid whatever they paid to get in. It is more accessible. It's bigger. All the tickets are spoken for three generations back. And while the crowd is unruly and emotive and into it, that's, I think, that amplifies the competition. Whereas England, Wimbledon is around the pageantry, which is great. And I understand, Mark, what you're saying about it's easy to get caught up in that. But on the day, if you're in the bowl and you've got that emotion, because that's what we usually get into sports for. I think it's just amplified. It's much more raw in Flushing Meadows, so I go US Open.
I just can't get the picture of Carmen, Pick, and Cavie walking around Wimbledon in 1993. Just picturing them, and
Yeah.
it's blowing my
Enjoying
mind.
strawberries and cream, no
Yeah,
less.
great. All right, that seems like a good place to stop. We'd like to thank Denver coach Bill Tierney for joining us this week. Best of luck to the Pios in the postseason, and we'd also like to thank today's presenting sponsor, Simplicity Group. Thanks, Bruce, for joining us. If you like what you heard, please like us on your favorite podcast app and leave a review. Tell a friend, it's free, and share the love. We always love to hear from you. Feel free to email me at dbflynn@gmail.com. That's D as in Dan, B as in Bennett, flynn@gmail.com. Or you can reach us on Twitter at Dixon Lacrosse, and I'm simply at D_FLY. It's May, and as always, enjoy the games.